certainly looking to you, Mr. Wyeth, for your thoughts about these provisions I'm going to put you to now. And you may not have had submissions that allowed you to deal with some of these matters, but I'm still interested in your views. And with time, either now or at the time of reply or whatever, I'd be interested in any solutions that you might have had. So I just want to take you through 25.5, 12, 13 and 14, these ones we've already talked about, because they all have similar issues. We've talked about 25.12, about the difficulty of, as a standard, interpreting and minimising the amount of sediment. In 13, again, it's minimising to the extent that it doesn't cause nuisance events. This is the on four roads, and the similar wording about dust in 14. Now, these are all additions that you've recommended adding to these rules, because the rules originally just said no material shall be transported from the site or deposited on a road, for example, and sediment leaving the site must be prevented. So you, on the one hand, you had that a standard, but possibly not achievable, and so you tried your best. So what's your view about my concerns about uncertainty and the exercise of discretion in order to interpret those?
Yeah, I completely agree, and I've considered these issues, and on one hand we're trying to have absolute certainty, and we're trying to make a standard that's also achievable. So I looked at all those standards. 25.12 was prevent, 25.513 was no material, and they used minimised 25.5.14. So I guess, responding to submissions in terms of the achievability of prevent and the nature of earthworks, that you can't actually control everything no matter how much good practice you implement. I tried to come up with some wording that was would still achieve a good outcome, would still allow that kind of compliance monitoring focus conditions. Say for example 25.5.12, you have got, it is very clear whether they are installed, sediment control measures installed and maintained. So that's your first kind of trigger.
Yeah.
That's your first trigger to go on site, and you can assess that.
I've got some.
So that and that's what I expect. So you could do that, you can assess that. If you go on site, or compliance honest it goes on site, and the adequacy of those measures is just not up to standard for the nature of those works. There is a bit of subjectivity there, but I think it does give that second limit of the standard, gives the council officer enough grounds to say you're actually not complying with the standard. Just there's clear evidence that sediment's not actually being contained or minimised to any extent. Although I certainly sympathise with the view that it's not absolutely certain, and some subjectivity is involved, I do think from a practical point of view, it will be a reasonable standard for council officers to go out and enforce. I've had experience dealing with this issue on the National Environmental Standard for Plantation Forestry. We went out for consultation, there was a minimised there, and we had a lot of concerns that wasn't certain enough for a permitted activity rule, that it needed to be certain and enforceable. But essentially, we couldn't come up with a better alternative, and we had to realise that it's not black and white when you're dealing with things such as earthworks. I guess in an ideal sense, from looking at 25.12, and if you look at the Auckland corresponding standard and the Auckland Unitary Plan, it basically says erosion and sediment controls must be measured and installed, or says best practice erosion and sediment control, and then the advice note says best practice is the guidance. So I guess in an ideal sense, we'd also be referencing some guidance here, and I sort of make that pretty clear by evidence, and I've sort of emphasised that in discussions with councils.
Is there any reason why we can't recommend the Aucklanders?
We just kind of toyed with that concept, because one submitter in particular says these if you don't have the stamina, this needs to be supported by guidance. So I think that's something we could definitely consider and come back to you on. There is other council plans that reference the Auckland guidelines, so this is
It's not an easy thing to write in a black and white standard type wording, except that. But the way that the Auckland plan is more direct, it says best practice must be installed and maintained.
Yes.
And although you could argue about what is best practice, the reference, even in an advice note to a guidance, is much clearer.
Would the same terminology be able to be used in relation to dust?
Yes.
Because the dust can be a particular problem. I'm not quite sure in the Queenstown side of the city and the outer plate in the spring with the strong northwesterlies. And it seems that best practice might be the only way that you can deal with that rather than saying no dust nuisance.
Does the Auckland guidelines cover dust as well? I presume it would.
There's a district-wide chapter there which deals with discharge to air, so dust would fall under that set of provisions.
Yes, but that is different again to the controls on earthquakes, which would probably come through the guidelines.
Certainly, like from 25.513 and 25.514, they are based on nuisance effects, and I imagine they more come into play when there is actually an adverse effect being created. So I acknowledge to a certain extent they are retrospective in nature. But I think that still gives council enough sort of ability to make sure people are implementing appropriate management practices.
But it would be actually good to be able to say implement best practice in relation to this and then advise how that's to be achieved, and that it can be replaced with something that the council's derived once it has done that.
Just to clarify then, in terms of Mr. Wyeth and his reply, what I'm hearing is it might be helpful to understand a little bit more about what other plans are doing versus what these proposed provisions are doing, and where some extra certainty could be gleaned from those other documents that would benefit the way these standards work. Would that be somewhat useful? I mean, obviously,
yes, it would be.
There's also scope considerations to take into account, and so that's what Mr. Wyeth is live to already.
But I think
these ones are clearly the scope because people have asked for them to be more certain.
Yes,
that's right.
And you've made an attempt to do that to make them more practical. But in trying to make it more practical and achievable, the certainty started to drop away.
Also,
so,
just for clarity as well, the G9 document that you mentioned does have a section on dust control as well.
And if, when you look at what other plans could work, they come up with, and you've used the example for Auckland, that means pointing this council to an appropriate guidance document in the interim. Feel free to make that suggestion as well.
Feel free. Feel very free.
The other question I had in respect of all of them, particularly 13 and more, is the extent to which that is standard on the permitted activities, the small scale of things, is it? There's always going to be a little bit of, someone gets one truckload of filth on their property, there's always going to be a small amount going onto the road. Is the issue with the deposition on the road is usually not big sites, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's the only place you can actually deal with it too, by putting in tire washing and stuff. You can't do that on a small site.
And for those smaller sites, I don't imagine they would depositing material that would actually be causing nuisance effects.
Mm.
So it wouldn't really come into play for those small sites, I would imagine.
Well, that raises the question. Is it necessary to be a standard, or is it a matter that really should just be a conditional consent?
And thinking about that, you have to think about what scale of activity is permitted, back to the volume controls, and say, is underneath those volume controls, smaller levels of earthworks in whatever zone it might be, and you've got the area ones as well, which takes slope into account, is there a need? I mean, there may be, I'm not saying there shouldn't be, but you need to tell us whether there's a need for standards of this nature on those top earthwork volumes and areas that don't trigger consent.
And if they are inappropriate to be on one conditional consent, is there a need for something that says these are matters which will be applied as conditions? I'm not sure how you do that technically, but
it may be that you've set the thresholds knowing that there will still be standards on these sorts of matters.
That's a good point. This is a new standard that wasn't in the operative district plan. I looked at examples elsewhere, and it's not a common standard in terms of good works.
No, it certainly imposes conditions quite frequently.
Are they allowed to would those areas be separately calculated? In other words, on the lower grades part of the site, they're allowed 10,000 square metres, and on the higher gradient part of the site, they can have another 2,500 square metres? Or how does that work if you don't average it?
That wouldn't be my understanding of how it should work in practice. You wouldn't be calculating that separately, like once it's triggered, it's kind of triggered and you look at the whole earthworks activity.
So does that mean that it should say if any part of the site exceeds 10 degrees or 10 degrees or greater, you can only have 2,500 square metres, and the whole site must be less than 10 degrees to get the 10,000 square metres? Well, yes, the area within the site that the earthworks are being undertaken.
Well, no, not even within the site, the area of the earthworks.
Yes, that's right. It could be over several sites. I mean,
yes.
I think it's very unclear how that's to be calculated. It
was intended to be a contiguous calculation, the total potential open area that you're going to be undertaking for the earthworks is your calculation within that site.
So if any part of that contiguous area of earthworks, no matter how many sites it goes over, is 10 degrees or greater, then the trigger point is 2,500 square metres.
Correct, yeah. It's not typical or good practice to try and split them out.
Can I say, my experience in sitting as a hearing commissioner in this district, that there will be people in this district who will attempt to split them out, so that will be looked at very carefully.
If that's the case, tie it down in the wording of the rule.
Yes.
The wording in relation to groundwater level in 21, I find a bit odd. It says earthworks shall not be undertaken, this is the new wording, because it used to say it shall not expose groundwater, so someone's asked for that to be changed. And so earthworks shall not be undertaken below any aquifer. So that's quite tricky. I mean, you don't really mean below the aquifer, do you? You mean below the upper water level of the aquifer. Within the aquifer.
Because,
I mean, people argue...
That's within the aquifer.
Yeah.
Probably
about
10,000
feet. Yeah.
That's assuming
that
not held as intended to
be read. So it means below the upper water level, or shall not be undertaken within any groundwater aquifer. Okay. So this is, it's just the way it's written, I mean, the new writer, but we've got, in these rules, we've got one table which are our activities, and earthworks related to clean fills are in that table, and then there's the standard, and then there's this table of standards, and yet this particular standard is written as an activity. It says earthworks where more than 300 metres of clean fill is transported by road is a restricted discretionary. So, am I right thinking either the whole thing should be transported and put back into the activities table, or this should be written as a standard that says no earthworks can transport more than 300 square metres of clean fill to or from a site, or something like that.
What's even more confusing is it refers to clean fill, but it's slightly contained out.
Yeah, I agree, and I look, because I think the effects here that's trying to be managed is having, it's the amount of material being moved rather than whether it's clean fill or not.
That's right.
But there was no, evidence of it, so there was scope and submissions to change that.
Yeah. But even if you have, I mean, even if it was just clean fill, it's really about you shan't move more than 300 square metres on or off a site.
Yeah.
That's the standard, isn't it?
Yeah.
And not...
And that's less than half a truckload.
Yeah.
Oh.
Cubic metres, sorry. Cubic metres, 300. Oh, no, that's huge.
Yeah.
So that's capturing.
Yeah,
so okay, so it's right that we can, if it was written as the standard is focused on the amount of material being moved.
The other thing is noticed with that now, it almost reads as if the issue is being transported by road rather than the volume itself, the way it's written.
No, it's really to do with on or off a site.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, but it doesn't mean from one site to another where they don't go on road.
It's about
that
material
off-site.
By roads is the issue.
You might, some judicial thing with the words.
If you can help us,
material might be a bit too many.
Yeah.
It might be better to say moved through the roading network or something to take it away from it to be a period of transport rule.
Now my last one on this vein is 25.4.5, which actually is back in that activities table. And again, this isn't something that you've turned your mind to, but we've got activities. This is earthworks that modify or damage or destroy Wahitapu, etc., of significance to Māori, whether identified on the planning maps or not. And it just seems to me extraordinarily uncertain to have as a standard damage to a site that's not identified. It's not like it's an archaeological site or something that has a precise meaning. And I understand that another stage of the plan is going to bring these sites into the plan.
Yeah, that's certainly my understanding.
It's just the old knot. There is an activity, how do you know to apply for it if it's not identified?
I guess the concern here is that until that mapping work gets undertaken, there's a risk that there's going to be no controls around adverse effects on Wahitapu that haven't been identified. So I think that was, the wording that was in there was deliberately intended to capture that, because the subsequent limit of that refers to heritage and features, that says identified in chapter 26.
So Ngaitahu, there is a submission from Ngaitahu on this chapter, isn't there?
Yeah, they don't...
not on this pool.
No, and, by all means, they were about, greater protection.
Greater protection, yeah.
A couple of sites, there was certainly nothing to give me scope in their submission.
No, in fact, the opposite.
Yeah.
They were looking for broader protection.
Yeah. So, and certainly in an ideal sense, all those areas should be mapped, certainly for both for iwi and for developers, but where they are and what consent requirements are there when work's been undertaken there. But in the interim, I think, given the directives of that.
And chapter 5.
Yeah. I think this is kind of like a safeguard.
Would it be assisted then if there was an advice note recommending consultation to ascertain whether they're a Wahitapu? Because that would be the only way that you would find out at the moment.
Yeah.
Or should it? Yeah. Should that all not be there until the mapping is in the plan?
Potentially. I'm just mindful of the, directing people to take consultation in all sort of situations. It should be good practice when you've got some, as you suspect there may be some Wahitapu there, you should be undertaking that consultation, or council should be advising you on that.
But seeing that's a discretionary activity if they are there.
I guess, confirmation of whether it is a Wahitapu would need to be done in consultation. So we could make reference to that potentially. That's
what I was thinking. I mean, the Ngaitahu would probably respond pretty quickly to someone ringing them up and saying, is there an issue on this site?
I mean, that's certainly the way I expect it to play out in practice. In terms of whoever it is, Wahitapu, you can connect with the iwi.
In terms of the matters of discretion, all the matters of discretion apply to all restricted discretionary activities, and you've bundled them together, and you've argued that that's more efficient, and it's tidier and a cleaner plan to have one set of matters of discretion for whose works and have them apply whatever the application's for. I just wonder, for something like the dust rule, 25.5.14, for example, it's quite specific, but once it becomes an RD, because they don't want to do adequate dust management, then all the matters of all the restricted discretionary matters are opened up for that application. And is that
I guess it relies on...
Because you say something about... Sorry, just... Because you do say, but of course, people don't do that. In fact, you even imply there might be direction and case law to say that you can't go looking at matters of discretion or that don't relate to the rule you're dealing with. Or are you just saying that in practice it wouldn't?
I was more meaning in practice. Like, there's no way you're going to look at, or say there's no cultural site relevance to that, to those dust and obvious ones that would be relevant, like nuisance effects, effects on public roads. I guess it's relying on good practice and common sense for both applicants and council to look at the relevant matters. Certainly you could look at the standards in 25.3 and potentially tie them to some more specific means of discretion.
Divide them up.
Well, you could have a separate column that said the relevant matters of discretion, 25.7.1.8, that's a potential approach. I don't sort of deal that I've had.
That's the way the Christchurch plan does it. There's a table and it tells you which ones to look at for which application.
Yeah.
Even though they're all in one list at the end.
Yeah.
Well,
you wouldn't do that for the volume and area.
No, for some of them it would clearly be all of them.
Yeah.
But some of them it just seems quite, opening up the field of conditions a lot wider than the rule actually relates to.
I think you have to understand that a lot of the consent members in this district are very inexperienced, and they will look at that and think, I have to find, is there any cultural or heritage issue there when it's a dust matter, where it's obviously not relevant, but they'll be thinking, I've got to search that out.
I could certainly provide you with a meeting table with some suggestions to that effect.
Right, because that seems to be within scope because you've done the bundling. Okay. And then my final question relates to the notification issue. You've said in 17, part 17 of your original evidence that it should be left to the normal tests. As to whether a notification is required, and there shouldn't be any direction in here as to non-notification or notification. I just wonder, for something like earthworks and the sorts of issues we're talking about here, is this something that council could really address or should be able to address itself about notification?
Generally, I'd expect in 99% of cases they would. I sort of have my general view is that council should have some discretion around notification. Say you're dealing with the setback rule and, there's no effects or the neighbours giving you a written approval or, there's no reason to get notified. Likewise in managing settlement, there's no need to should be no need to sort of notify other parties in terms of how that should be managed. Council should be able to impose conditions itself.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's relying on a bit of good practice, I guess, in terms of what council should be doing.
I'm just concerned that there are some activities that lend themselves more to being just broad brush non-notified than others.
Yeah.
And to me, earthworks falls towards that end anyway. It's something that the council should have the expertise, the best practice implementation to deal with without having to, an inexperienced consent. Well, I think
it says, shall not require written consent or person, shall not be notified, except. Or is it only that rule that is?
It's only that rule.
Whereas
I think
Mr. White's
saying everything else should just
leave
to the normal tests.
Yeah. But I can see that setbacks from boundaries probably needs to have the adjoining landowners involved.
I guess, potentially larger scale stuff when you're talking about kind of the landscape or border amenity effects, potentially.
But then there are all the landscape rules that would also be applied in terms of if it was in an O&L or particular amenity area.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just something, if you have got a chance to think about that again.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I have to ask again my fellow commissioners as to whether throughout, whether you, you know, throughout the whole plan, is there a philosophy of notification and non-notification? And has there been a principled approach to what the council, how the council sees notification, non-notification, no written approvals through all the chapters?
I'm not aware.
And you've never seen a list of criteria?
No, there wasn't any sort of clear guidance in terms of why, the rationale for this, you know, the call back to the non-notifications in the operative district plan. Assuming I can get some advice from council on that.
But it's certainly helpful that those sorts of approaches have been thought through at a higher level. Right.
A few sort of clarifications of what happens in many ways, but earlier on there was discussion about the relationship between vegetation controls in chapter 33 and the earthworks rules. Again, there's a contextual question that relates to SNAs and ski field overlays. How many of those are there SNAs within any of the existing ski fields?
I can't answer that.
I'm trying to understand how big an issue that actually is. You did get onto that. We talked about the relationship between the rules, but not whether in fact it's. I'm trying to understand how big an issue that might be.
Yeah. Sorry, I haven't got the understanding of that.
Next issue I just want to raise, just one other one, is the infamous was into rebuttal evidence. Paragraph 5.19, it's the Ben Lomond scenario with forestry activities and earthworks. Now, we have a submission on this much bigger subject. Again, Mr. Dean is going to come along for that. I'm trying to understand how this is working at the moment. There is a talks here about the currently able to be approved by an outline plan, is it a designation across the site that they deal with?
Yeah, outline plan under designation.
Yes. So,
that applies
under there. That's my understanding. Okay. Then it goes on to say, without consent, forestry activities in Bedlow and subzone are a controlled activity under decision rule 3811.14. And what the submitted there is saying, well, that being the case, there's no need for an earthworks control. Visibility of that site to the whole central Queenstown. Are amenity issues able to be looked at as part of the earthworks?
Yeah, I mean that controlled activity rule says forestry harvesting, and then there's no sort of standards related to earthworks. It just has earthworks as a matter of control. And what I'm sort of saying is earthworks within that subzone should also be subject to all the standards in 25. And then if they breach any of those, then you bring in consideration.
Yes. So basically what you're saying is there needs to be sort of an additional distinction between the forestry on one hand and the earthworks on the other.
Yeah. So you consider the output forestry effects and the earthworks effects. Each would be subject to those considerations.
I'm sure everyone wants to discuss preventing it.
On page 51 of your notes, we're talking about amendments to the assessment criteria. Oh, that's policy 25212. And you've got there is C, protect values of significant natural areas and minimise adverse effects on the margins of lakes, rivers and wetlands. What about the waters of lakes, rivers and wetlands?
I mean, that's a relevant consideration. I hadn't looked into that because he wasn't in any sort of submissions related to it.
You weren't the author of the change of the provision, so I don't know if there's a general question that would.
No citizen would have made me consider it, so I didn't specifically focus on it.
On page 72, you're talking about the Heritage New Zealand submissions on archaeological sites, and you're talking about those that are not identified in chapter 36. You are aware that there are no archaeological sites listed in chapter 26 now, are you?
So
there may be buildings which are archaeological sites, but there are the hearings pattern, three of which are sitting here, recommended that the archaeological sites be deleted out of that chapter. And I know there's an appeal to put them back in, but
so my wording and my intent was to specifically reference those, each of those schedules in chapter 26. So you know, specifically refers to entry of listed heritage features, and there's no reference to archaeological site.
Yeah.
So that was intended to provide more certainty around identified sites.
What about archaeological sites?
That are not identified.
They're identified by Heritage New Zealand or the New Zealand Archaeological Association, which readily available information.
I mean, there's also the archaeological discovery commission.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of kicks in.
Well, that's how you discover it, not all archaeological.
Accidental discovery protocol.
Yeah, I think it relates to all archaeological sites.
Just on page 84, you talk about the earthworks volumes project point zone. And you say, my expectation is the different earthworks volume limits for the activity areas of Jack's Point are specifically considered by council when developing the zone provisions. They were considered when they notified chapter 41 and then they were withdrawn and moved into this chapter. Is that what you're referring to, the consideration?
Yeah, so obviously there's 500 cubed, there's the 1,000 cubed, there's the no maximum, and they were essentially brought over into chapter 25 without any change to those. And I guess what I was trying to say is that coming up with those different thresholds, consideration was given to a appropriate level of earthworks that could be undertaken in each of those activity areas.
Yes, but it wasn't, not by the hearing panel, just by the
some discussion about on the objectives and qualities about maintain and enhance, moving the word down enhance, and I'll take the point with regard to the amenity values of the rural landscapes. But do you still feel that is valid for public access? It's got maintain and enhance public access to it along lakes and rivers.
Yeah, I guess. You know, typically a real quick shoot, you're managing the adverse effects rather than sort of, I guess, looking for opportunities to impose requirements to also maintain or improve something. So I guess the reason why that was appropriate to delete it is, you know, not to suggest that council should be imposing all these conditions that they enhance public access as part of it, focus on managing the adverse effects. If, you know, through discussions, yeah, we can, you know, to offer up some maintenance or enhancement of public access, then, you know, it doesn't preclude that.
Yeah. That's fine. Well,
thank you very much.
Final chapter of Part B of Stream 15. Science. So we did pass brief submissions addressing science, which you have in front of you. Start at paragraph 8.1, where we summarise the more substantial matters of dispute remaining between the council and the submitters, including the prohibited activity status for billboard signs, exclusion of posters within shopfront displays from being classified as signage, and the permitted number of event signs visible from the state highway. These legal submissions address two issues only, provide some comment on Plan Change 48, and we also address the prohibited activity status for billboards. In terms of PC 48s, two submitters oppose the proposed prohibited activity status for billboard signs in rebuttal rule 31.5.14. Spark also states in their submissions that chapter 31 is attempting to reinsert a prohibited activity status. And that comment by Spark stems from the fact that a relatively recent council plan change, PC 48, introduced provisions that made hoardings a prohibited activity under the ODP. PC 48 was then appealed, the consent order issued on the 5th of June that changed the activity status from prohibited to non-compliant. In earlier hearings before this panel, it's been submitted for the council that in general terms would be permissible for the panel to place reliance on the Environment Court's consideration of very similar issues in the context of the plan change appeal process. However, that submission was balanced against the requirement to consider the proposed PDP approach against the requirements of sections 32 and 32AA. The earlier legal submissions for the council identified a number of factors which would make it reasonable to have regard to and place some weight on a decision issued by the Environment Court. which included the relatively recent consideration by the court of various similar issues, high level of scrutiny by the court in relation to the provisions and alternatives, and the council's intention to effectively integrate the plan change approach into the structure and the style of the DP. Council submits that there are several reasons why placing reliance on the consent order issued for PC 48 should be approached with a degree of caution. And those reasons are that the order does not provide any detailed consideration or scrutiny of the evidence relating to the relevant provisions. The order acknowledges that it has been made by consent rather than representing a decision or determination on the merits. The council has now notified a different planning approach for billboards, which it is justified for the purposes of Section 32. And the consent order was issued before there was a requirement to do with Section 32 AA evaluation for any change made by the Environment Court, including as part of a consent order. While acknowledging that the council was party to that consent order, on the basis of the above factors, it submitted that because the Environment Court was not asked or required to interrogate the evidence for the proposed prohibited activity status at that stage, the panel should consider the evidence before it is part of this hearing and determine activity status based on that. Ms. Leith has provided extensive evidence as to why, in her view, a prohibited activity status is appropriate, and Council considers that this position should be preferred to that of PC 48 and the consent order. In terms of prohibited activity status, the leading authority in terms of appropriateness is the Court of Appeals decision in Coronado Watchdog. In that case, court was provided with a number of scenarios where prohibited activity status was considered appropriate, and it accepted the relevance of those, but also, importantly, it accepted that council may decide to take a precautionary approach in relation to particular activities and apply prohibited activity status in those scenarios. Ms. Leith's evidence is that because of the considerable growth pressures in the district, signage is not properly controlled, and that includes billboards. There may be a proliferation of such signage and resulting adverse effects. While it is correct to note that there has been no consent applications for billboards since the consent order was issued by the Environment Court, it does not mean to say a non-complying activity status is the most appropriate, particularly in light of the recast of objectives and policies in Stage 1 and Chapter 31, which place a greater emphasis on particular districts and landscapes. Pause at that juncture for any questions, but if not, we'll move into evidence from Ms. Leith. Okay, well, we've got Ms. Leith here now, who's the author of the 42A report, and who has also filed a rebuttal statement. So Ms. Leith, have you read your summary?
Okay, my evidence considers the submissions on Chapter 31, signs, and the signage-related definitions included in Chapter 2. The strategy underpinning Chapter 31 is to provide for signage where it is located, designed, and of a suitable size and number, so that the potential environmental effects, particularly visual amenity and safety effects, can be avoided, minimised, or mitigated in order to maintain a quality environment. On this basis, I consider that the Chapter 31 provisions represent the most appropriate way to manage signage in the district. I consider that my recommended amendments to Chapter 31 provide the following benefits in terms of efficiency and effectiveness. Clarification as to the interrelationship between the district-wide signage rules and the zone-specific signage rules. Providing for signage within the ski area subzones, acknowledging both their commercial nature and their location within the outstanding natural landscapes. Differentiation between the definition of off-site signage and billboard signage. Inclusion of signage within the setting or extent of place of heritage and archaeological sites to identify that signage in these locations may result in effects on heritage values. Providing for signage along public pedestrian and cycle trails to acknowledge that information and directional type signage is expected and necessary. Amendments to the time period that sale signage can be displayed to make the time frame less stringent, so not to unduly affect business operations and to be more readily enforceable. Prescribing a standard relating to signage displayed adjoining a state highway to address potential traffic safety effects, providing for digital signage platform provisions to acknowledge this advancement in signage technology, and amendments to the zone specific standards for Millbrook and Jack's Point Village. The key outstanding matters of disagreement between myself and submitters who have filed evidence relate to prohibited activity status for billboard signs, where I consider that the prohibited activity status is appropriate because of the impact that these signs could have on the visual amenity of the district's commercial zones. I consider that if billboard signs were to be provided with a consenting pathway, a rationalisation of the size requirements of signage within those zones may be required to offset the potential cumulative adverse proliferation or dominance effects within streetscapes. The exclusion of posters within shopfront displays from being classified as signage, where I consider that this exclusion would result in confusion, given that posters are already included within the definition of sign and signage, and due to the effects relating from soap poster signs being the same as other static signage. And the permitted number of event signs visible from the state highway, where I consider that the permitted number of signs should remain as notified due to there needing to be a balance between the potential adverse visual clutter and dominance effects on the environment and the need for event signage to advertise upcoming events and or to acknowledge sponsors. Thank you.
Just as a starting point, just please. How different is Chapter 31 from the signs provisions that were included by Change 48, other than the billboard?
It's very similar. There are a few minor changes, but that's probably the main change.
Okay. So the outcome that we could expect from Chapter 31 is reflected in the nature of the signage we see in the district at the moment. That is fair assumption.
That's a difficult question, given that I think a lot of signage erected in the district is probably does not have resource consent.
Okay. So what examples, please?
I don't know of any specific examples, or I'm not. I am aware it was probably about 10 years ago that council did I've forgotten what they called it. It was kind of like a signage moratorium. You know, come in and get your signage legitimised, and we won't take enforcement action. And that brought in a little bit, but not much. And so that from there, they systematically went, particularly down Shotover Street as a start. But the effort was tedious, and I think things it didn't go anywhere, I guess. So that signage assessment did highlight that there's a lot of signage there, existing signage that doesn't have resource consent.
In your view, then, is the signage in the town centres, as it is at the moment, creating adverse effects, whether or not it has consent? I mean, there's a regulatory issue, but, you know, is what we have not too bad? I'm just trying to get a handle on, you know, the effects of the two problems.
I think there's some areas that are absolutely fine. I find that when I visit Wanaka, that the signage appears to be a little bit more restrained than what it is in Queenstown. But then in saying that, there's some areas in Queenstown, town centre, where the signage is also quite restrained. I'm just thinking in particular of Church Lane has been quite nicely controlled as part of that, the redevelopment, and the same with the development along Cow Lane. My personal view of looking at shot of the street, I think it's probably too much as it currently stands, because where you look, there's signage up, on the large signage above ground floor, as well as a lot along the ground floor.
So that are the concerns that you raised in terms of shot of the street addressable?
They are addressed somewhat in terms of the notified chapter. So the ground floor signs in the notified chapter, the standard, has looked at buildings with multiple tenancies. So at the moment in the operative district plan chapter, there is a 15% specification for all ground floor signs, regardless of the size, whereas the notified Chapter 31 now has 15% or 5 square metres, whichever is the lesser. So if you've got a small tenancy, obviously your size is restricted, and also if you've got a large tenancy, for example, the big retailers out in Franklin Flats, they're limited as a permitted standard to 5 square metres, and then everything above that needs to be assessed.
Is the direction of council to have a control on signage in the town centres such that there would be less signage than you might expect in other New Zealand town centres?
I've had no direction
You haven't picked that up from?
I haven't picked it up at all from the documentation. It seems to be status quo. It's okay, because the notified chapter is not significantly different to the existing operative chapter.
Going to some of the details in your evidence. In your section 42A report on page 40, you talk about making a recommendation that corporate colours to neutral assessors should be excluded from the corporate colour scheme. I'm just wondering how easy is that to enforce.
That's something when I was preparing for the hearing, I flagged and thought that was going to be a little bit subjective, and that I need to do some work on that. I've identified that is tricky, and then I went and did some research into colours and how to categorise them, and got into research of intensity and saturation and value, and I haven't got to a point where I need to think of something better that's less subjective. So leave that one with me, and I'll come back with something better.
I'm not an understanding that the financial reason for the Bunnings, which I think we're going to establish on the side of the shop over gun centre, is that they were declined, I think, primarily on the basis of signage, wasn't it? Were you aware of that particular
months ago, is signage and traffic and urban design, was my understanding. I'm not sure where it's gone on appeal.
I'm certainly aware from the Christchurch scenario, but Mike and Megan tend to classic example of Christchurch, very good example, where the very bright orange and black colour is an integral part of the, this is who we are, this is us, we're here. Mm-hmm. So, it's more possibly not so much the fact that it's part of the science, is that the colours they choose are extremely, orange doesn't fit almost any environmental background, does it?
No, that's right, and yeah, I think that
usually
acts as a sign.
Unless, of course, you're an orange roughie, and then it's
seasonally of course, thank you.
Now, you make the point about that, make a way of turning the needle for the
Yeah, that's right, but you know, Bunnings have what you could call a recessive green as their corporate colour, so yeah.
Recessive green is a big hammer.
Yeah.
I do wonder about it, when you're reflecting on that, if there's any chink, you know, if you use corporate colours or corporate colours, and we accept there's an argument one way or another, when you start debating what's an appropriate colour, it becomes quite sensitive. Mm-hmm.
I think before